It's great to be here, not least because I think John's right when he talks about something bubbling up. I think we're at an incredibly interesting time at the moment. I think we're potentially at a tipping point. I think this is one of those moments where we have the possibility, potentially, to completely reshape education. So I think this is a very exciting place to be. However, when we talk about skills for the future, we tend to often operate in the abstract. What I want to do is get us started by, if you like, locating ourselves physically within it. So I want to start off with a question that is a little unfair to ask at this time in the morning. How old will you be in 2035? Quick tip, it's whatever you are now plus 24. All right, now, think of a child starting school now. How old are they going to be in 2035? What do you think the world's going to be like then? And what are you basing your assumptions about that future on? In education, we use the word the future, preparing for the future, a huge amount. Policymakers use it. We use it when we have conversations with children. We say to them things like, you know, this isn't going to help you when you grow up, or what's that going to do for you in the long run, or what do you want to be? We embed our discussions in education with ideas about the future. And yet often we don't really think about what that future might be. So really, that's what I get roped in to talk about today. So unsurprisingly, I've spent 7 or so years working for an organization called Future Lab, clues in the name. I had to do a bit of thinking about what the future might bring. I also headed up a project called Beyond Current Horizons for the then DCSF, which was about bringing together everybody from neuroscientists to gerontologists to labor market analysts to educators, sociologists of childhood, to try to understand, if you like, what the big trends were likely to be over the next 20 to 30 years. And what we were trying to do was understand, if you like, what this future is that we think we're trying to prepare young people for. Now, having spent nearly 10 years trying to look at and think about the future, I've come to this conclusion that we can't predict it. It isn't possible to predict the future. And I want to give a simple example. Think about the Newfoundland cod stocks. Now, this, it turns out, is not cod, by the way. But it's very pretty. I think it's mackerel. Are there any fishermen in the audience? Okay, it's not mackerel. All right. Well, I'm not quite sure what it is. Don't put me in charge of fisheries. That's the message from this. But you'd think that it would be fairly easy to work out the question, to look into the future and figure out just how much fish can we take from the water in order for fish stocks to carry on. The scientists spent years modeling this. They worked stuff out. They developed their set of strategies and models. And in the mid-1990s, the cod stocks fell off a cliff, completely fell off a cliff. And what happened was that while the scientists were working out their models, we weren't listening to some of the local fishermen who were saying things like, well, you're treating it as though there's only one sort of fish. There's actually multiple sorts of fish. There's different species. And they were saying things like, you've forgotten the mother fish. And there are these big mother fish who are very important, who go around producing lots of fish, and the little fishermen never used to take those out. They'd leave them there. And they also said, you've forgotten that us fishing is going to change the environment. It's going to change the world in which we're operating. And so the assumptions you made as though we weren't doing this aren't going to be valid. Now, the reality is that if we can't even model something as simple as fish stocks, we're really in trouble when we're thinking about modeling long-term futures. And I want to talk about this in relation to new technologies. Now, this is an area I've been working in for a while. And when we started the Beyond Current Horizons project, I was asked pretty much to come up with a plan of what the big technological developments were going to be over the next 20 to 30 years. Could you tell us what those are? And then we'll work out what education ought to be doing. All right? So that was the request. So what I want to talk through now is the whole range of different technological developments that are going on. And we can ask, well, what might this mean? So you've got a whole bunch of people working on things around constant connectivity to people, to information, to networks. We've got a project, I'm working on a project at the moment, which is about building the information aura around a person, which is about saying, how do we harness the data that is being captured about us on an ongoing basis? Did you know there's Bluetooth scanners in the cities, for example, that are recording the Bluetooth signals from your phones? And they keep a record of which phones went past, and not just that, but when and with which other phones? Think about it. So we've got a bunch of people working on building constant connectivity. We've got a bunch of people working on building massive computer power on demand, who are working on, for example, the ability to phone Japan and have a phone conversation with instantaneous automatic translation on demand. Raises really interesting questions for languages teachers, that sort of development. We've got people working on merging the digital and the physical space. So you've got a guy called DK Arvind, for example, working in Newcastle on spec computing, which is about embedding the environment with digital technologies that can, if you like, talk to, connect with, and learn from each other. You've got the ability to overlay onto the physical environment a whole range of digital worlds and identities. A project we did 6 years ago called Savannah overlaid an African savannah onto a school playing field and challenged children to learn how to survive and hunt like lions. We've got people working on large-scale complex systems of systems, so trying to figure out how all the different systems that we've got interconnecting with each other will play out. This is really important stuff. Last year, the New York Stock Exchange lost $1 trillion in 2 hours. It got 846 billion of it back after 2 hours. Two slightly worrying things about that. One of them is, if it had happened 2 hours later, the chances are we'd have had a serious world issue because the markets would have opened in Asia. And the second issue is that we don't know why the collapse happened. Now, so we've got a bunch of people working on those sorts of systems. We've also got a huge investment in military uses of digital technologies. We've got the development of nanobot armies and drones. We have young men in various places in Washington state dropping bombs from unarmed drones in Pakistan at the moment. So what does technology mean for the future? The reality is it's completing, it's conflicting, it's competing, it's contradictory. And more importantly, it drops into the societies that are already there, and societies are very difficult to forecast. So when you think about one of the big areas of development, we're looking at biotechnical development and the growth of things like cosmetic pharmacology. This is a report from a study that Nature did a couple of years ago, saying to parents, do you think your children should be allowed to, you should make your children use cognitive enhancement? And as you can see, 86% of them said, no, they shouldn't be using them. But one third of respondents said that they'd feel pressure to give cognition-enhancing drugs to their children if other children at school were taking them. So the point of flagging this is to say that the future is also, when we're looking at technological development, it's a consequence of the societies and cultures that we drop these tools into. If we have got a competitive education system based on individual advancement, then these tools are going to come in and fuel a massive arms race in education. We need to think about that. That's a separate issue. So, the point being, if we can't predict the future, we might not be able to predict the future. One of the things that I think we do know, however, is that business as usual for the 21st century is going to be highly unlikely. The phrase that the futurists use is the 21st century canyon. And yeah, it's not a good word. It's not a positive thing. So what I want to do just now is say, we don't know what the future is, but there are things pushing in certain directions that disrupt the assumption of business as usual. So let's take the first one. Let's think about demographics. Okay, so how many of us, by 2035, are going to be aged over 50? Yeah, okay. So current forecast at the moment, 50% of the population of Western Europe by 2035 will be aged over 50 with a further 40-year life expectancy. 25% aged over 65. We've never lived in a society like this. We don't know how to do it. We're used to a society that's shaped like this. Small numbers of old people, large numbers of young people, you know, keep it going. We're shifting into this sort of situation, and the reality is this is not a Western phenomenon. If you look at what's happening in Asia, fertility is dropping off a cliff as young women decide that they actually quite like their jobs in the city and they really don't want to go home and have loads of kids. So we've got a big uncertainty in the next 20 to 30 years around how we're going to learn to live with the potential of conflict between different generations over access to public resources. We're already starting to see the beginnings of these debates and discussions around how we deal with the deficit, around end-of-life care. In Germany, there's a new center called the Center for Intergenerational Justice. Okay? So there's an interesting question about whether that takes us to conflict or whether we can think creatively about how this builds new forms of intergenerational cohesion, because we actually have to think about it. And then if you take seriously somebody like Ray Kurzweil, who argues that if we get to 2020, you'll probably be able to live for another 500 years. His argument, whether you'd want to or not, discuss, but his argument is you get to 2020 and you're able to surf the next wave of medical development that gets you to 2050 and surf it again to 2070. So it's plausible, which raises interesting questions about lifelong learning. Okay, next big issue being raised is the emergence of growing inequalities. The last 20 years have seen a radical transfer of wealth from the poorest in society to the richest. When you look at forecasts for the labour market, we see the large corporations. You know, the narrative that's been going around for the last 10 years has been, we're shifting into a future knowledge economy, it's all going to be lovely, everybody's going to be creative, they're all going to be able to have their own skills, and it's just going to be delightful. But actually, when you look at what's happening in global corporations, you see an incredibly small bunch of people actually taking the roles where they're able to make decisions, where they're able to act autonomously, where they're able to have some sort of leadership. You're seeing an erosion of the middle roles, and you're seeing a large number of people working at a lower level, effectively doing what the computer says. Think about the banking industry for a moment, and then think about something good. We're seeing a growth in competition for those creative and autonomous roles as international companies are recruiting from global talent from the world research universities. We're seeing a casualization of middle-class employment where you have jobs that were previously skilled and secure, like the legal profession, having increasing amounts of their work outsourced not only internationally but to volunteers. So take, for example, patent law. There used to be a challenge. As a lawyer, you would go and look for prior examples. Now they post that on the internet and volunteers look for prior examples and get paid for it. Or think about the pharmaceuticals industry. We've just seen what's happened in the country with the closing of Pfizer. We are seeing a shift where the previously well-paid knowledge-based jobs that were in R&D organizations are effectively being outsourced. Companies are shrinking those, and what they're doing is they're setting big challenges. And they're saying, we've got these 10 challenges, and if you're able to answer those challenges, you'll get £1 million. So you've then got lots of small labs competing with each other in order to get that. The one who wins is fine. What about everybody else? So what we're seeing, and if you really want to look at this, there's a brilliant piece of work by Phil Brown, David Ashton, and Hugh Lauder called The Great Education Swindle, which is about making the case that the argument that formal education is going to guarantee well-being and long-term survival is getting increasingly tenuous. So, and the third point. This gets cheerier, by the way. The talk goes like this. It goes like this, all right? And then it comes back up, so stay with me. So, environmental and social disruption. We need to recognize that we are in a situation where we will be confronting significant energy shocks and resource constraints over the next 20-odd years. 80% of our food is dependent on oil supply. If these prices are going up, there are serious questions about how we organize our structures and our societies. At the same time, if you look at the implications of climate disruption, we pretty much have a 2-degree temperature rise built in. The fight is about how to keep it to that. With a 2-degree temperature rise, you're looking at 45% species loss. You are looking at Bangladesh and Pakistan being increasingly covered with floods. You're looking at the Mediterranean basin increasingly unviable as a place to live. So we are also looking within the UK at interesting relationships between the southeast suffering from drought and the northwest underwater. There's a group called the Global Scenarios Group, and I would very much encourage you to have a look at their work. And their suggestion is that one of the risks we face over the next 20 to 30 years, when you pull together demographic changes, economic inequalities, and the sort of environmental and resource disruption we've been talking about, that you shift towards a situation of serious breakdown. Those of us who saw the riots this summer would know how fragile civilization is. So, If we can't count on a business as usual future, what then should education do? So, option one is the kind of all change model. It says, right, business as usual isn't sustainable. Let's go for a new plan. We'll assume that we're all going to hell in a handcart, and what we'll try to do is figure out how to live well within it. And there's groups like the Dark Mountain Manifesto group who are doing this sort of thing. I have slight concerns about it. I think we head into Dad's Army territory. We're all doomed, Mr. Mandling. Anybody remember that? No. Okay, so... You end up with Ivan Illich's phrase. He warns us to beware of apocalyptic randiness, which I just think is a fantastic phrase, which is where you just go, oh, and another thing, have you heard about nanotechnology? And what about, you know, where you just sort of throw everything on top. And the risk is that you kind of bring it about and you terrify yourselves into inactivity. So I have a concern about replacing business as usual with apocalypse. It's not one or the other. The second option is future-proofing. And I think... this is becoming prevalent in education. I think it's the response where it says, we don't quite know what's coming up, so let's try to cover all the bases, right? So I'm not sure what my school's going to be like, but we'll have folding walls and we'll have sockets everywhere. And you know, I don't know what class, but we might, you know. So it's sort of, let's prepare for everything. Now, the risk is this potentially is banal. It's also potentially, it's a very defensive position. It's the future is something we have to kind of protect ourselves against. We're always on the back foot. And it doesn't really give us a purchase for making the change happen that we might want to see. So what I would suggest is we need a different approach. We need an approach that is about future building, that is about imagining the possible futures we might want to see happening, looking for those seeds and those examples of where this is already in development, nurturing these possibilities and recognizing that we need to work to tip the balance. And I think this phrase, tip the balance, is what's important for me, because we have to get rid of the old idea, the 20th century idea, that there's this kind of grand plan that we're all heading in that direction and we'll just shift and we'll all go in this one. The world is too complex for that. It really is. What we're trying to do is find the points of intervention. We're trying to nudge it. And it gives us a modest role, and it's a role that's actually achievable. So, what does this mean for schools? What does this mean for what future building schools should look like? Well, my sense is it's a school that should help students, communities, and staff to create space for seeing possibilities for better futures. I think this is about creating space for wonder. Wonder, I think, is an important word. It allows us to say, oh my God, look at the miraculousness of that. A world in which there are starfish, for example, which are the strangest things on the planet, is a world where many things are possible. It's a world where human relationships, where you know other people's names and know enough about them to see what their possibilities might be. The second thing that the Future Building School does is it supports us to build allies and collaborators. It's a school that recognises we can't do this on our own and that supports young people to also realise they can't do it on their own. And it's also a school that is about recognising its own powers. And schools are massively powerful. Potentially, you are the most enormous power. You are employers. You are consumers. You have buildings and spaces that can be used in a whole range of different ways by your communities. You've got, in some instances, 1,200 young people who can all conduct research in some ways. You can generate knowledge. And you're also educators. You've got people who have knowledge and ideas and experience and are able to communicate this to the world. So for me, if we're going to think about future building, these are the sorts of things we need to be thinking about. Now, there's a lot of schools beginning to do this. And Christina, I know, will talk about inquiry-based learning and project-based activities. So there's all sorts of things that are going on. But I want to flag up things like Young Rewired State Hack Days and Apps for Good. These are about recognising young people able to make changes in their environment. So you've got young men in Hackney, for example, creating iPhone apps that allow them to know their rights in relation to stop and search. And if you look at the reports that have just happened recently about causes for the riots, you will know that that is an important thing. You've got projects like Earthforce and World Changing all around the world that are challenging young people to say, how do we make the world a better place? And you've got schools recognising their own powers in terms of things like saying, well, we're not just going to try and sort out our own food provision, we're actually going to try to tackle the food poverty in our local community. You've got schools like St Christopher's who are not just saying, well, we'll recycle ourselves when we become a building schools for the future school, which they did, but we will set ourselves up as a green hub for the community. And there are many more in this room. In terms of finding allies and collaborators, when it comes to curriculum and students, we can look at cooperative and collaborative modes of learning as absolutely critical. But I would also like to flag up, because for some reason, and I don't know why, it doesn't enter the UK very much, but the funds of knowledge approach that originates in Latin America, and that I would argue has formed the basis for a huge amount of the political change in Latin America, is really a curriculum approach that starts to say, how do we think about schools and communities and parents working together? We've got projects, as we know, like the Peterborough curriculum that the RSA is leading on. We've got things like the Education Justice Collective in the US, which is about supporting parents and communities to act as a powerful voice for education. And there's a brilliant radical educator in the US called Jean Anion, and she says, schools have no idea how amazing it is to have the power of your community actually behind you. And then I think the last point is critical. I think it's so easy in the current climate and so easy when we try to think about the future to act quickly. And I think there's a real case for saying, how do we create space in our schools and in our communities to slow things down, to have a look at what the possibilities might be? And I think the work of human scale education and slow education is critical here. It's about saying we cannot begin to see the nascent possibilities for creating better futures unless we take time to look at the world around us and to look at the people around us. There's a beautiful project called the Nottingham Wonder Room, which actually has a very old history. There's in the 1920s, A.F. O'Neill had a school called Prestonleigh, and he used to have in his school a museum of uninteresting objects. And he used to challenge the children, bring your object in and it can stay in the museum if you can explain to me why it's uninteresting. And the other kids would be shouting at it, no, it's really interesting because. And it's that sort of close, focused attention to really looking at something. And actually this is where disciplines play an important role alongside cross-curricular work. They allow you to look closely at some things. Now, I want to just link to another quick video, which is of, not yet, hold, stop, which is of a festival that happens in Bristol each year called the Interesting Games Festival. Because one of the things that I've found by doing a lot of this futures work is that we can just terrify ourselves into the position where we go, I just don't want to think about this. I'm just going to go back. I'm just going to go and sit in a corner. And one of the things I think we need to do is to remember the only way it becomes worth fighting for the future is that we remember that life is quite joyful, that it can be playful, that there are exciting things going on, that working this out can be an exciting and interesting creative challenge. So I want to show this because it's about how a group of young people are reimagining the city spaces in Bristol by completely reconfiguring it as a space for play. So you will see, for example, the local car park being rethought as a site for three-dimensional noughts and crosses. You will see a moose hunt going on across the city. Now, if we can do this sort of thing, we can start to think creatively about new possibilities. Now we can have the film. Wave.
Inkfest, yeah.
A great chance to see a very rare and splendid beast out in the wild tonight.
I had a dream. When I was alive, I had a dream.
If I was on a tree's stone, I buried my dreams underground. Else did I drink to die?
Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
Okay, if we go back to the slides, thanks. So one of the reasons I want to show that is because play is a way of us mucking around with different possibilities. It's a way of us thinking about how things might be different. One of the interesting things that's happened as a result of this is that Bristol City Council now has an official zombie pandemic readiness level the council. So this is the point that I want to get to. I want to suggest that we've got real challenges, but that we have survived disruptive change before. When you look at the changes that people were confronting in the 19th century, they were looking at crazy stuff like the development of electronic light, which changes your biorhythms. I mean, this is kind of fundamental. Growth of extreme poverty, early globalization, mass production. And they responded to this with a rich educational imagination. It was a really rich measure. It wasn't just about tweaking around the edges. It was about, well, what should the relationships be between adults and children? It was, you know, we're going to ban child labor. I mean, the ambition of the imagination that was involved is enormous. So I think this is really what we need to be doing today. I'd like to finish with my favourite Gramsci quote, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. We need to recognise what we may be up against. But at the same time, we've got to recognise all of the resources and all of the powers that we have to support each other, to have enough courage and enough optimism to work our way through it. As my grandmother would say, this too will pass. So I'd like to finish on that point. Thank you.
Kerry, thank you so much for... what was maybe sometimes...